This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Every week, the chefs at HelloFresh come up with new healthy recipes, and they send everything you need to make them in this insulated box to your doorstep. If you want to try it out, you can get 50% off your first week of meals, which can come out to as little as $6 a meal. To give it a try, go to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter and get 50% off. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the online mattress company that manufactures and ships exclusively within Canada, which means that they can avoid international shipping charges, currency exchange, and duties. And what that means is that their mattresses are cheaper than their competitors, even though they've got better ratings. Get $50 off any mattress by going to endy.ca, that's ENDY.ca, promo code IMPOSTER. Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Leah Pabani.
In the future, they have discovered that the number one threat to their winning the war, and they don't really ever tell you what the war is the rise of crippling anxiety and depression in the ranks.
That's Erin G. She's the creator of a virtual reality game called Project Heart. It's based on popular first-person shooter games. You know, the kind where you're shooting stuff from a first-person perspective. But instead of embodying a soldier, you're a holographic pop star named Yawane Haku.
If I die, it's because I didn't try hard enough.
Yawane Haku, whose name means speaking weak words, is a fan-made derivative of a virtual pop star named Hatsune Miku, whose name means the first sound of the future. She's a 16-year-old voice synthesizer software with long turquoise pigtails. And even though she does better with pop, rock, house, and techno, she can pretty much sing any song that a user inputs.
She's kind of like a really advanced garage band, but she's also a logo and an avatar and a corporation and, you know, and also a huge fan base of people that just like make music videos for her and like make content for her. And it's amazing, like the love and care. But she is literally like the empty sign that people pour their affect into.
When a Hatsune Miku song didn't do that well online because it was bad, it would become a Yawane Haku song. She's like the darker, shadowier version of Hatsune Miku. Kind of like the Wario to her Mario.
Even better is Waluigi, because
I don't know what Waluigi is.
Okay, he's like Luigi's version of Wario.
Oh, they called him Waluigi?
Why not Waluigi?
In the game, you visit troops in combat as Yawane Haku, and she's hovering above this roving disc that looks kind of like a Roomba, and you have to sing to them so that they don't become too depressed to keep fighting. What makes the game even more complicated is that all the soldiers are controlled by an algorithm that makes them affect one another's behavior on the battlefield, too.
Like, if they kill someone, then they get more depressed. Mm-hmm. But if they shoot someone, then they're happy because they succeeded, so they get pumped up. And also, like, they react to each other. So if, like, one of them gets depressed, it's easier for the rest of them to be more vulnerable now. And there's lots of elements that I chose to use that I think kind of, they kind of almost psych you out a bit. Like, they say these things like, do you really care if anyone lives or dies? And another one is, does sincerity matter?
Your sincerity is inspiring me.
I'm losing my grip on reality.
I resent my participation.
My technology is superior.
Everyone dies. Not everyone truly lives.
The thing that I really aimed for with this game is I didn't really want it to be that easy to read, because sometimes like you have these Kotaku tech reports that are just kind of like, finally, a video game that is a, you know, the feminist answer to war games. And I'm just like, ugh, really? And I mean, like, you it's almost like a knock-knock joke, like, knock-knock, who's there? Feminism. Whoa, it's you again. And so I'm interested in how much war might be a part of our private lives in this very entertainment, militainment kind of way, and how very, very little we really understand about the psychological aspects of it. Like, the games that we play are often about refining your rifle skills and your ability to like see things in the distance, but not often about psychological elements of being in a war. And I don't think my game does that necessarily at all. But I was just really interested in pushing this psychological element and making this a main narrative drive. So in the same way as like shooting a gun in Call of Duty does not prepare you in any way for like, you know, being in a real war, in the same way my game does not prepare you for like escaping trauma. But it's imagining a different kind of heroine, actually, for a battlefield kind of futuristic war game.
The thing about Project Heart is that in other video games, whether it's a virtual reality game or, let's say, a traditional video game, the thing that allows you to play always involves some sort of voluntary physical movement. It's about tapping some buttons in a particular pattern, or gesturing slightly with your limbs, or turning your head around to locate yourself in the landscape. You take it for granted that what happens in the game is a direct result of what you put into it. Project Heart is much more complicated than that, because it's controlled by your emotions. To play Project Heart, you sit down in this office chair that's a bit over the top, like something the CEO of a visual effects company would use, and then you put on an Oculus Rift. If you don't know what those are, they're like VR goggles, basically. And then you place your middle three fingers on a biosensor. That biosensor tracks your excitement levels. And that's what makes Yaone Haku sing.
Can you explain a biosensor a little bit more for the me?
Yeah, sure, sure. Sure. So biosensors kind of could mean anything, right? It's like, what do you mean? You're sensing my biology? But I don't know what else to call them, because it gets really science-sounding super fast. Like, some people have come up to me and been like, what exactly are you measuring? And in my head, I'm like, should I say sweat and heart, or should I say photoplethysmograph and galvanic skin response? What kind of person are you? And I can't tell.
So Aaron's biosensor is made up of something called a plethysmograph. And what it does is, it tracks when and how much blood is flowing through your body based on the changes in your index finger.
Basically, if you look at your skin right now, on your fingertips, I'm looking at my fingertips right now, your human eye can't see this, but your skin actually very, very subtly changes color with every heartbeat, because that's the amount of blood going through your skin.
So your skin's a bit transparent. And it becomes less transparent when blood gushes into it. The plethysmograph shines a light on your skin to track its transparency. And after the blood comes the sweat. Aaron's biosensor detects levels of sweat in your skin from your middle and ring fingers using the same device that they use for lie detector tests.
Sweat is this like byproduct of emotion, as far as I can tell. It's like you know that expression, you get a rise out of someone?
Mm-hmm.
Is that if you get a reaction, like if you're meditating, your sweat actually just kind of evaporates off your skin. Nothing's really produced. It just kind of slowly dissipates. And you can see the sweat levels go and go and go. But then if something happens in the background, like someone just closes the door, even that door closing causes like a slight startle response, mm-hmm. and you'll see the sweat pop up again. And I don't know exactly why, but as I've said before, like laughter, when you laugh, you produce just like mountains of sweat.
And that's part of the reason why she chose to make a game that runs on excitement. It's just a lot easier to measure.
I've seen a lot of kind of like GoFundMe campaigns for like fear-driven horror games. And I thought, oh man, that's going to be hard because like some people are going to have the fight response and some people are going to have the flight response. And like fear is complicated. Hmm. Like just think about people you know, how differently they react to stress. That is reflected directly in their bodies. And that's why emotional physiology is so tricky and so fascinating. I mean, like, as an artist, I just need to show you that. And I need to, like, you know, give you and show you the materiality of this. But as scientists, oh, man, that would be frustrating.
As it turns out, emotional physiology has been frustrating scientists for centuries. And the way we tend to think about the connection between our emotions and our bodies isn't how it plays out in the research. So the way we understand it is that, you know, you're at a party and you see someone you went on a couple of dates with before they stop texting you back, and you feel embarrassed. And that makes you blush and sweat a little. We think that the body's sending blood to your head because of your feeling of embarrassment. But in reality, your body sends blood to your face before you even have the slightest bit of awareness that you're embarrassed. It's almost like your body knows you're embarrassed before you do.
My body has an automatic response to a stimuli, and because of my body's automatic response to the stimuli, there's a small lag between what my body is doing automatically and my experience of that emotion. The reason why is because you have to imagine like almost this evolutionary need for emotions. So your body figures out in an instant what it's going to do.
That idea that physiological arousal triggers emotions, it's called the James Lange theory. And it was developed independently by two scholars, William James and Carl Lange, in the mid-1880s. And since then, it's become a bit of a clusterfuck. Last year, it was discovered that the James Lange theory didn't come from either James or Lange, but that it was invented by the philosopher John Dewey, who kind of misrepresented James's research. A 2009 study involving patients with brain lesions argued that it's not so much that the physical responses cause the emotion, but that they might not even be related to each other at all. All that to say, the fact that it's hard to be aware of, let alone control how your body reacts to stimuli, that can make the experience of playing Project Heart feel a bit conflicted.
A woman came in and she was commenting on how she said, "I hate war. I don't want any more of this killing to happen. If my soldiers become depressed, then they won't fight anymore." So she said, "I want to be sad, sad." But obviously she thought she was very funny. And so, like, she kept on cheering up the soldiers.
She was very excited about her proposal.
Well, and that's the thing with these biosensors is that even when I was working with them myself, like, they kind of, your body doesn't lie. And so these constant questions of sincerity in the game of like, are you being sincere? Because even when I was testing them, I would sit there and be like, "Oh, be happy. You're so happy. Ha ha ha." And it doesn't work because it's just silly. And I actually would have to fail multiple times and then laugh at how bad my fails were.
Because Erin couldn't emote enough to playtest her own game, she had to hire some method actors to do it.
We moved through, you know, surprise, anger, sadness, fear, and happiness. And Yeah, there were some actors that were very frustrated that they couldn't do it because it's very, it's not necessarily how they were trained. I mean, in acting, it's often that you're kind of playing against another actor or a circumstance or a narrative. And for me to just kind of like say, like sit there and turn your emotions on, they have to have incredibly detailed and imaginative inner lives to generate this kind of stimuli on their own.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't you decide to actually have something they were responding to?
Well, artistically, I found it fascinating, the idea that someone might be able to play their emotions like a cello. Like, to be, like, the master of emotional expression and, like, the master of your emotional inner life. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the actors I work with really do have this ability, that I could, you know, they can craft an inner world for themselves that's very distinct and interesting to witness. They went to some pretty deep, terrifying places. It's not necessarily fun. Like, it is a roller coaster and it is scary and you are in a completely, like, safe environment, but I don't know if I want to ask the general public to do this.
Mm.
I think for this one, I was interested in doing something that I thought the public would be capable of achieving success with, to produce a stimuli that was contradictory, to produce, you know, a game that was about war, that kind of exposed these war narratives as really kind of like conflicting, trite, bizarre, and like asking you to have an emotional response of joy rather than like, you know, horror or sadness or something like that.
...2016 has been called the year of VR. And that's largely because it was the year that the Oculus Rift, Facebook's virtual reality headset, hit the market. There's been a new interest in the possibilities of virtual technologies across industries, far beyond gaming. In healthcare, they're using VR to treat phobias and to simulate surgery. The United Nations backed a VR film called Clouds Over Sidra, which brought viewers into the experience of a girl in a Syrian refugee camp. VR is being foisted upon willing investors as a kind of empathy machine with world-changing capabilities. But Aaron's not sold on the idea.
Corporations are interested in volume, like in giving us trailers and target markets, and their target market is everyone. And so in an effort to reach everyone, why don't they give a technology that gives everyone something everyone agrees on? Empathy. We're all feeling disconnected lately, aren't we? Time to buy something. And, you know, to feel more embodied, to feel more present. And instead of, you know, meditating or being able to access free time because you're working multiple jobs, you don't have as much freedom physically when you're busy to be anywhere you want to be. And VR gives you this amazing fantasy that you can put your attention and now your body anywhere that you want it to be.
This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Every week, HelloFresh teams up with chefs to create new healthy recipes, and they chop and portion the exact amount of everything you need to make those recipes, and they deliver it to your doorstep in this recyclable, insulated box so that when you come home, you can make a meal in 30 minutes that does not look or taste like a meal you made in 30 minutes. They post meals on their website with nice pictures of the food so you know exactly what you're getting, and you can sub things out if you like. This week they've got coriander spiced pork with couscous and herb salsa, and halloumi with charred vegetables and cannellini bean salad. I read HelloFresh's entire FAQ section, and here's what I learned. If you live in a city, if you work full time, if you don't know how to cook, if you have kids who are picky, if you are the one who is picky, if you're a vegetarian, if you have commitment issues, if you go out of town a lot, if you like variety, if you have a family, if you don't have a family, if you live in a place where people consistently steal packages that are left outside your door, if you're a member of the creative reuse community, if you literally only have salt, pepper, sugar, milk, butter, and oil, maybe you want to try HelloFresh for a week. See how it goes. You can get 50% off your first box, which can work out to less than $6 a meal. Go to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the online mattress company that manufactures and ships only in Canada, which means that they can avoid duties, currency exchanges, and international shipping so that they can keep their prices lower than their competitors. My friend Gina sold all her stuff and moved to Vancouver with her partner Mick last year, so I gifted her an Endy queen-size mattress because I am selfless to a fault. They've been living with their Endy for a couple of months now, and then last week, Gina went to visit her mom in Edmonton, and she had to sleep on this spring mattress in her mom's spare room. Jillian, if you hear this, I'm really sorry, and your spare mattress is probably really nice. Anyway, I got her to send me a voice memo about how she was sleeping, and it wasn't going well.
I woke up yesterday morning with this terrible twinge in between my shoulder and neck, and I just spent all day, like, complaining.
Later that week, Gina went back home to Vancouver, back to her Endy mattress, and completely unprompted, she sent me this voice memo.
Hey, I just wanted to report that I'm back in Vancouver, and my neck and shoulders feel just great again, back on the Endy.
If you want to know the pleasure of getting back on an Endy after sleeping on an uncomfortable spring mattress for a few days, sorry, Jillian, you can get $50 off any Endy mattress by going to endy.ca and entering the promo code IMPOSTER at checkout. That's endy.ca, promo code IMPOSTER. There's a place called Abtec Island, and it's covered in these stunning, futuristic movie sets. One of them's a modern, angular building that's surrounded by searchlights, and above the entrance, there's a neon sign that says, Time Traveler. In front of the building, there's an animated display that features a man changing outfits. In one of them, he's shirtless, but he's wearing a large plated pendant and white sneakers. And then, he changes into a cheetah with a red headdress and a matching cloth around his waist. Across the top, it says, Introducing Hunter, the most extreme time traveler. Inside the building, a giant screen shows a woman dressed in black with a head covering. She's putting on some futuristic-looking goggles, and then some words appear.
Do you have what it takes?
Yes.
You.
And then, the image shatters. There are costumes and spears and shields on display, but the place is otherwise empty. There's just the sound of a fire burning outside, and the more distant sound of flowing water. In the center of the square, there are these four benches, and they're glowing in pink, orange, blue, and yellow light. There's a giant white mound-like structure with circular windows and stairs running up the outside of the building, the way they do in the Greek islands. Inside, there are several tables. On one table, there's a pyramid of champagne glasses filled with some mysterious blue liquid. On another one, there's a tree-like egg holder with giant eggs in it, and a glowing white one that sits at the top. It's sundown. Magic hour. It's always magic hour here. There's a sign that says, Welcome, in Mohawk French and English, to Abtec Island, an aboriginally determined territory in cyberspace. So in order to visit Abtech Island, you have to go through Second Life. So last week, me and producer Ali Graham signed up for Second Life. I should pause here for a sec. You might have heard of Second Life, but maybe you're not sure exactly what it is. Second Life launched in 2003, and it's amassed around 1 million users. It's kind of like those massive multiplayer online role-playing games, except that it's not a game. It's far more open-ended, and the narratives emerge from the users. They create all the objects and all the environments in the game using a 3D modeling tool. Second Life even has its own currency, Linden dollars. So to enter Second Life, we needed to create an avatar.
I feel like if we're going to an art gallery, like to be on a horse is a lot.
Okay. You got boring witch.
I'm a witch.
Should we just be like a white man in a suit? Because
he's like, oh, wow. This is stunning.
I'm looking for somewhere for my donation. I don't know. I'm kind of feeling like Amulet Girl.
Okay, let's do it.
How do I go there? Teleport.
Wow.
Okay, let's go.
Oh. Okay. Oh, my God.
Okay, so we're on Abtech Island, we're standing in what looks like a...
And when we finally arrived, we met Skawinati, the artist behind Abtech Island. Her avatar was a silvery violet-haired femme named XOXO Voyager, and she was speaking to me from her place in Montreal while her son played video games in the background.
So, come on, I'll take you over here. Follow me.
Okay. In order to understand how and why she decided to create Abtech Island, you have to go back to the late 90s. Even though people were using dial-up modems and could only communicate through a rudimentary thing called internet relay chat, there was this pervasive belief that the internet would create deep connections between people across vast geographical spaces, and that was going to liberate oppressed people around the world.
I actually can't remember exactly the line that I bought, but I bought it, you know? And there was a very specific problem at that time that I felt I saw, which was that I felt more aligned with contemporary Native artists that I met in different places in Canada than I did with the people in my own reserve. Mm. When I first met those people just 1 or 2 years earlier, it was like finding your soulmate, you know? I was just so happy. But these were the days when we still weren't, had long distance fees to worry about, you know? Like, people would only call long distance on Sundays because it was a third the price.
Skawinati was looking for a way to connect with Indigenous artists across the country in a more consistent way. And that's when she discovered this place called The Palace. It was kind of like a chat room, but
instead of a chat window, you had a window, but it had a picture in it. And on top of this picture were avatars. This is the first time I heard this term avatar. And the avatars were just smiley faces, like full-on 70s smiley faces, you know?
And that what's was a 70s like, smiley face look like?
What's a 70s smiley face? You know, the yellow face with the big smile and the two dots for eyes. It's what a smiley is now. It's what it's based on.
Okay. I didn't realize that it started in the 70s. I thought it was based on like a hieroglyph or something.
That's funny.
The palace had a lot of different rooms that were customizable depending on the preferences of the users inside. Skawinati started exploring.
You know, it had like these big overstuffed leather chairs and your little smiley face would position itself in your chair and pretend to be sitting in it, you know, and you could talk to other people. So even, you know, a lot of people, we've talked a lot about the fact that it was called the palace, you know, imperialistic, white, male, you know. And here are these Native people going, we want in on that.
And that's how Cyber Powwow was born.
The first Cyber Powwow, we just met in that palace and talked. And so there was people in Montreal, people in Saskatoon, one person, you know, in Washington, D.C., I think. Oh, and we had made some art, too.
but that was in a web page. So we were meant to like look at the web page, which was really, it was, you know, pictures of work. And we just went into the palace to talk about that stuff.
And one of the first issues we had to address was the fact that a lot of people thought that indigenous people couldn't do digital art. Like, basically, you could be indigenous, but, you know, if you did digital art, it wasn't indigenous art.
They were bringing their art and the conversations around it into one of the first public online forums on the internet. But, as you can imagine, when online spaces are open to everyone, it means that anyone can just come right in.
Another palace user, not connected to us, had written this script. What it did was that if he, I guess he or they typed zap, then this big, like, cartoon electricity bolt would go from him to you, and, like, you couldn't talk for maybe 10 seconds, which meant to say you couldn't type or move for a few seconds.
What?
And it was extremely disruptive and annoying. And so we said, you know, we need our own space. We need a place where we can, like, decide who's in and who's not so that we can have this conversation. And while we're there, we're gonna make it look like an indigenous space. We're not gonna have like overstuffed leather chairs. We're gonna have like the inside of a teepee, man.
But this was the late 90s. Not a lot of people even had access to a home computer, let alone a dial-up modem. And this was a particular issue in indigenous communities. So they established these gathering sites across North America where people could go to access the internet and log on to the palace in real space together.
When I was there, I was on the computer and so happy to be like talking to all these people who some I knew and some I didn't know. And you're like, hey, you're XOX. I'm YZY. You know, where do you live? Oh, Montreal. Oh, where do you live? Oh, wait a second. Are you Archer Pachawis? You know, and it's like, no. So all that is to say that I was very happy sitting at the computer. But a lot of other people who attended in the physical space were like, hey, is there like food here? You know, like, I'm not just going to sit at this computer the whole time.
Skowinati was hooked on the palace, even though it was just a bunch of static GIFs layered on top of each other. So you can imagine how she felt when she found out about Second Life.
All I remember is like, it's Barbie. I was like, it's the palace and Barbie together. You know, Barbie can walk. You know, I can talk. I can fly. Oh my God.
This time around, she gathered a network of artists, technologists, academics, and gamers. Basically, people who all really wanted to live online. And they had a common purpose: to make sure that Indigenous people were present in cyberspace. So in 2006, they created Abtech Island. She paid Second Life about $1,770 US a year, and they gave her this big square of virtual land inside of a virtual ocean. The land has a limit of 15,000 prims, which is basically the virtual equivalent of building blocks, and they started looking for objects to make the island into an actual place. It's cheaper to buy things in Second Life than it is to spend the hours modeling them from scratch, but there were some things that couldn't be bought.
Nobody was selling a celestial tree, or at least not one that was like how I wanted it to look, so we had to make that.
Piece by piece, they built this world. But they were new to Second Life. They didn't know the culture yet. And even though Skowinati's early experiences getting zapped in the palace might have foreshadowed what they could expect, the permissions on the island were set to open, and that made it vulnerable.
One of the permissions that was open was that you could build anywhere. Anyone could build anywhere on our land. So one day we showed up and there was these cubes that someone had put all over the place, like many, many cubes hanging on, like we had a street at that time. So it was like, imagine like walking the street and there's like cubes floating all over the place. But on each face of the cube, there were Nazi swastikas and or masturbating big fat white guy and pictures like that. And so we were, you know, we learned pretty quick.
So, Abtech Island wasn't just built to be a beautiful refuge. I mean, it is that. But the thing that makes it more than just a destination is that all the assets, the trees, the fires of various colors, the museums, the longhouse, the boutiques, and the animals, those are all set pieces for films that they shoot in Second Life. It's a place for indigenous people to come and create narratives that aren't subject to the limitations of the real world. Those films that they make are called machinima. It's a term that combines the words machine and cinema, and it describes movies made in a virtual environment. Skowinati's got this 9-episode series called Time Traveler TM. It tells the story of a 22nd century Mohawk man, Hunter, who uses an edutainment device, these lightweight wraparound glasses, to transport himself to watershed moments in Indigenous history and future, but it's told from the Indigenous side.
Traveling through time these days is easy, thanks to Time Traveler TM. Witness important historical events or interact with the people who made them happen. You can even customize your own events and visit with your great-great-great-great-grandmother. All customized characters must have existed. Visit www.
In one episode, he goes to 1875 and he ends up in this small assembly hall where some settlers in red uniforms are watching a hand-cranked motion picture.
Tonight, on account of it being Christmas time and all, we have a special treat. Mr. Nestor Vance's great panorama of the West.
Ooh. Ah.
It's a piece of propaganda, and it depicts an event where members of the Sioux Nation went on a rampage and killed hundreds of settlers. The next one ends with 37 Sioux being hung for treason in the largest mass hanging in American history.
In other words, we're the worst bunch of criminals this country's ever seen. Maybe our problem is bad press.
But like any good series, there's a love story too.
That puts the active in interactive mode.
What do you mean?
Well, the fact that I'm sitting in my storage locker in Montreal in 2121 and you're in your comfy bedroom on the res in 2011 and we just kissed and it felt like an electric shock.
Oh, you felt an electric shock, eh?
Yeah, let's do it again.
In the final episode, a character named Karakwahawi travels to the year 2121. She has a decision to make. Should she move from our present to live in the future with Hunter? Or should she stay in the present with her family? She needs some space to think about it, so she visits the Museum of the Future, which is in the future, and she goes to the early 21st century Indigenous art section so that she could be surrounded by familiar artwork that's from her era.
Hey! It's the Kadri from the shrine in Ganawage.
And because Skowinati needed to fill a set with Indigenous artworks from the present, she asked some of her friends.
I had specific artworks in mind. I really wanted ones that would look right, I guess you could say, in Second Life. If I had a photograph of a real person, wouldn't look good in Second Life because I'm pretending that the avatars are real people. So I needed like it to look a certain way. So for example, right now I'm looking at David Garneau's piece, Not to Confuse Politeness with Agreement. It's got a bit of a comic book feel to it. And it even has like little thought bubbles. It has a native guy and an RCMP officer standing very close to one another, like they're talking, but the thought bubble of the native guy has a red circle and the RCMP officer has a blue square, you know? So like they're being polite, but they're not really communicating. But I guess the one more difficult piece to include in a, you would think, is Hannah Claus's cloudscape.
Most of the work in the museum is mounted on the walls. But in the center of the space, there's this sculpture that's made up of hundreds of little white discs that are suspended from these thin wires to form a cloud-like shape, and it's catching the pink-orange light from certain angles. Unlike in real life, you can walk into the middle of it and wrap yourself in all the little discs. You might imagine that it would have taken hours and hours to render.
I happen to know that she was working with one of our students to visualize this sculpture. What the student was doing for her was basically creating the sculpture in a 3D modeling program. I asked her if I could try and import it into Second Life, and thanks to my brilliant producer, Nancy Townsend, like I don't think I would have been able to do it myself, She figured it out and brought it in, and it became a really important part of that episode.
It's Skyworld.
The thing about Time Traveler TM, and maybe Machinima in general, is that despite the elaborate sets and the slick camera work, the emotional value of the film is diminished by the fact that the characters can't really do complex emotions.
So when Gorok Wahawi, you know, makes a sad face, it's kind of ridiculous looking, you know, but I didn't have any other options available to me. So we're doing the project, and, you know, every time you log into Second Life, Second Life gives you some kind of message, and they were starting to give this message like, new update coming, something amazing, just wait for it, oh my god, you're going to be so happy. And we're like, oh, it's going to be facial expressions, oh my god, we're going to be able to animate their faces ourselves, or there's going to be more of them. You know, we were so sure. And we were sure not just because we were wishful thinkers, but because of a book. In, you know, they say Second Life is based on the metaverse, which is from the book Snow Crash. And in that book, the author describes this place called the metaverse. And the metaverse is where you can be your avatar, and you can, you know, like, poor people can be rich people if they know how to code. And, you know, it's a place where people meet and people do business and people do basically all the things that people do in Second Life now. And the myth of the origin of Second Life is that its creator, Philip Rosedale, I think is his name, he read Snow Crash and said, I'm going to make that. I'm going to make the metaverse. And he made Second Life. And in the book, there is a character, this cool chick, I can't remember her name, I think it's Juanita. And she is like a revered coder in Second Life because she brought facial expressions to the metaverse. So when all these advertisements and announcements were coming on Second Life about the next great thing is coming, I was like, oh, that's why I thought it would be facial expressions. When it came out, it was boob jiggle.
No.
Boob jiggle. Like, exactly. I was, you know, and I'm okay with boobs. I really am. Like, you gotta be in love with Second Life the way I am. I'm okay with the bodies that they have. But, you know, like, for that to be the thing, I felt like walking away that day.
She had just assumed that everyone in Second Life was more like her, that they were in it for the metaverse.
But I think the people making porn in Second Life, or like basically providing cybersex for people, were the bigger, louder, better paying users.
There were also rumors that Second Life was going bankrupt, and Skawinati realized that she was dependent on a company to make her work. And that didn't sit well with her. So now, she's thinking of going in a different direction.
I've been making costumes for all my avatars for years, and I used to sew, and so I think that's where it's going to go. I mean, I already made one piece called Dancing with Myself. It's a photograph of me and a photograph of, well, I call them a machinimagraph because I took it inside of the virtual world. And so we're wearing the same thing. And each of us, I had to iterate on the design of the real world costume and on the design of the Second Life costume until they matched. Like, it's much easier to make a collar stand up in Second Life than it is in the real world, you know? I wanted to make a costume that the two of us could wear.
What's going to happen when they leave Second Life? What's going to happen to Abtech Island?
As long as Second Life exists and we remember our avatars' accounts, we will have all these things we've made. If we stop paying for the land, we will not be able to, you know, have them out anywhere for people to see. They will not be arranged in any way. They will effectively be in storage.
There's something really poetic about that. The idea that this whole world would become a collection of digital artifacts buried deep in a database somewhere. And that The only way to get to them would be through a single character, whose password will somehow have to change hands over time. That whole world. All those histories and projections. It's a kind of time capsule for the present. Locked inside a corporation. And the only way to get it back is with $1,770 US a year. In the real world, it's so difficult to even imagine, let alone create spaces like this. Indigenous people are in an ongoing struggle for their land, their space, for their right to self-determination. Abtec Island is this utopic vision of the future. And the feeling of being there, that feeling of rootedness, the wonderment, the unguardedness, it really made clear just how hard that feeling is to come by. The possibility of this place no longer existing was heavy. But Scott and Adi seemed resolved about it.
Maybe, you know, for a time it makes sense to have all Indigenous institutions so that we can level out the playing field. You know, and then once we get there, maybe we can all be together. Because that's really what I think needs to happen. I would really like us to let go of race, you know, as a construct. But at the moment, our race is very important to us. You know, I'm pretty proud of being Indigenous, you know, and it's part of who I am, and it's you know, our existence is resistance, as we say, and it's true. You know, my ancestors, my mom all the way up, you know, they really fought to make sure Mohawks continue to exist, and I'm not willing to give that up. You know, at the same time, you know, I love Star Trek. And what is Star Trek? Star Trek was about race not mattering. I mean, of course, it kind of still did in Star Trek, but you know, that's what they were trying to show. And I think it's a beautiful dream. And I'm heading in that direction. I don't know if I'll make it there in my lifetime, you know, but I think it moves very slowly. And sometimes it feels like we're going backwards too.
That was Skawanadi.
I don't want to be my avatar. She does have a more gravity-defying body than I do, but I'm the one who gets to eat and have sex.
And Aaron G.
Some of the ASMR artists, they really whisper really quietly to you. In particular, I really like the funny little things that people do with their mouths when they don't know what to say. Like that.
If you want to watch a playthrough of Project Heart, or if you want to visit Abtec Island before it goes underground, you should go. It's really nice. Go to canadalandshow.com/imp. I produce this episode with Ali Graham. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton, and Nathan Burley does our theme music. The music on this episode is from Jesse Perlstein and Carl Dieter. We also got a bunch of songs from the Free Music Archive, including songs by Hip Fractal, Poddington Bear, Broke for Free, TRG Banks, Parvis Decree, and Komiku. You can follow us on Twitter at Impster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, where we'll be posting all the avatars that didn't quite make the cut. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.